The campaign to save the vaquita porpoise, the world's most critically endangered marine mammal, centers on waters off the coast of Mexico, but it has implications that extend much farther. Captain Paul Watson, founder and CEO of Sea Shepherd, a marine conservation organization, says restaurants and even ecotourists are complicit in the destruction of endangered species around the world. I asked him what it would take to reverse the trend.
What it takes is, the passion, the motivation to do it. And that's what's been lacking on the vaquita campaign.
Why do you think that is?
Well, they raised $4 million to do a project where they were going to capture them and hold them in captivity. Of course, all that money came from the captivity industry, like SeaWorld and everything. When, in fact, we've demonstrated that there is a solution. The vaquita would now be extinct if it wasn't for our interventions over the last 3 years, and we're now in our fourth year. And that's simply to police the vaquita refuge, to confiscate all of the illegal nets, and we fly drones at night and catch the poachers. So a little more support with the from the Mexican government and others, and we can cover that refuge quite adequately. I don't see any point in saving a species if you can't save its habitat.
What's the attraction for poachers?
They're not going after the vaquita. They're going after another endangered species, a fish called the totoaba. Now, the totoaba bladders, when dried, sell in China for about $20,000 a kilo. So that's a lot of motivation to go break the law. So it's smuggled over to China, and they throw them out. The rest of the fish is just thrown away. The totoaba is about the same size as the vaquita, a little under, around 3 feet, 3 to 4 feet, and they just throw them away, take the bladders. And they're not targeting the vaquita, but they're caught as a bycatch in the nets, along with hundreds of other animals. We've found thousands, really, of everything from sharks to turtles to birds to sea lions. We've rescued hundreds of them that we've cut out of the nets before they died.
I've only recently become acquainted with this term bycatch, but it means the many, many creatures that get caught in nets that the fisher folk aren't even looking for, right?
Yeah, they're just caught by accident. They're not targeting them, but these nets are very indiscriminate.
How does a gill net work?
The animal or fish actually swim into it, and they can't back out because their gills get caught in the net. But the problem is they're a lot like spider webs, so when a vaquita or a sea lion or encounters them, the net tends to wrap around the body, and they can't get away, and they drown.
Slowly, I would think.
Very slowly, yeah. It's very painful for a marine mammal, for instance, to die of drowning.
This is a long-standing effort, just in general, the protection of species like this. And yet it continues, does it continue largely because of the whole nature of the way fish are caught in offshore waters like this?
Well, it's mainly because of greed. 40% of the fish that's sold in restaurants and supermarkets has been caught illegally. Sea Shepherd is running anti-poaching operations all over the world. Right now we have a ship off Liberia, another one on its way to Tanzania. We've been active this last summer in the Mediterranean with bluefin tuna. And we're just targeting poachers. We're not even a protest organization. We're just an interventionist anti-poaching organization. And all over the world, this is becoming an increasing problem because as fish populations diminish, the demand increases, the prices increase, and they want to go after them.
What you're describing is a kind of a complicity between the restaurant industry and illegal fishery around the world.
Well, yes. Because, for instance, Patagonia toothfish, which is sold as Chilean sea bass, is an endangered species. The amount that comes into the United States alone exceeds the world quota. So there's a big black market.
That particular dish, Chilean sea bass, is frequently seen as a luxury item on a restaurant menu. When you see that on the menu, are you have a kind of complicity? Are they talking about the endangered species you just described?
Well, they have this thing called sustainable fisheries, but I haven't yet seen any of these sustainable fisheries. For instance, I was in Whole Foods, and I saw they had sustainably caught toothfish or Chilean sea bass, and I said, well, where did you get this? And they said, well, there's a special sustainable fishery off of the Falkland Islands. I said, no, there isn't. You just put this word sustainable on it, and all of a sudden it is justification for everything.
Well, we're seeing a lot of buzzwords in grocery stores these days with not a lot of attribution, right?
No. There's very little, in fact, a lot of the fish that's being sold, for instance, isn't even the fish that you think it is. It could be tilapia or other fish. There's a lot of mismarketing on this whole thing.
How do you get that under control?
Well, that's the problem. It takes, an economic and a political motivation on the part of governments worldwide to stop poaching. Right now, most of the poachers can be easily found in marine reserves, like sanctuaries. About 300,000 sharks every year are taken out of the Galapagos Marine Reserve off of Ecuador, and we're doing our best to stop it. But there's so many of those poaching vessels out there, and just not enough enforcement.
It's the governments who establish these marine reserves, but you're saying the governments establish them without enforcing their regs?
Oh, absolutely. They have no enforcement. I mean, one of the biggest marine reserves in the world is the one that George W. Bush established in the waters around Hawaii, thousands of square miles there, and yet there's very little enforcement in there.
You're talking about the Northwest Hawaiian Islands. Is it just because it's such a vast area of ocean, or not much concern has been given to enforcement? Where's the flaw here?
Well, the flaw is, again, a lack of economic motivation, political motivation. Even President Trump said the other day that sharks were certainly not a concern of his, even though many of these species are extinct and we're killing 75 million of them a year, primarily illegally. And he displayed exactly what the government's position is on this. They really don't care.
If people don't care, you've got your work cut out for you. How do you reverse a trend? Like, how do you reverse a mindset that's obviously a pretty prevalent mindset?
Well, we do the best we can with the resources that we have. We now form partnerships with Mexico, Gabon, Liberia, Tanzania, Italy, Ecuador, Peru. And these partnerships that we're making allow us to provide the resources, and they provide the authority. So every day we're arresting poachers off of Africa or off of Central America, and we can do that because they provide the authority to do so.
It sounds as if a lot of the awareness that you want to foster happens, should extend to people sitting down at the table in a restaurant.
It should, absolutely. But, for instance, to give you an example of this, if you go to Iceland, where they're killing whales, the average Icelander doesn't really eat whale meat, but it's in demand in restaurants for tourists. So tourists go to these places and order these exotic dishes they can't get at home, for example. So ecotourism, strangely enough, is a real problem.
Ecotourism has been a driver of killing endangered species.
Yes. If you go to the Galapagos, 15 years ago when we started our project in the Galapagos, there was very little fish being caught. It was pretty manageable. But now, of course, the tourists go there. It used to be 50,000 tourists a year. Now it's 300,000 tourists a year. They all want fish. They all want meat. They all want the luxuries. They cut down, mangrove swamps to build an ecotourist hotel, for example. And, of course, they're bringing in more fish, and they're bringing cattle and meat from the mainland. It is causing all sorts of problems. People should travel as travelers, not as tourists making these luxury demands on the places that they visit.
The people who go to an ecotourist resort or who shop at a high-end, natural food store don't think of themselves as being part of the problem, do they?
No, they don't, but they are.
Captain Paul Watson is the founder and CEO of Sea Shepherd, a marine conservation organization that is launching Operation Milagro 4, an effort to save the critically endangered vaquita porpoise. You can find a link to Operation Milagro on the Conversations Facebook page. This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up in the show, the Navy takes a look at its effect on the marine environment. But first, your quiz. In today's backyard quiz, we're looking at one of the bird species in Hawaii that have evolved curved beaks, the kind that are ideal for extracting nectar from flowers. The bird we're thinking of is known by its Latin name, Vestiaria cochinea. It's a small red bird with black wings and tail and orange legs. This member of the honeycreeper species has a pronounced salmon-colored bill that is unusually long and curves downward and is described in the Hawaiian Encyclopedia as among the most spectacular of all the honeycreeper bills. Researchers believe its long and downward curving bill came about as an adaptation to the shape of certain native lobelia that have long tubular-shaped flowers. This bird's bill fits perfectly into the petal array of the lobelia. It's a remarkable adaptation, and we're looking for this particular honeycreeper's Hawaiian name. Call 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. The first one to get it right gets our reusable tote bag that tells people you got it right.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributors Locations, Ekahi Ornish Lifestyle Medicine, and Hawaii Pacific University.
The U.S. Navy has been operating in Hawaii waters since the early 19th century and has been testing military ordnance and sonar offshore for decades. But today it does so from a place of environmental concern that took a long time to realize. Alex Stone with the U.S. Pacific Fleet Environmental Readiness Division is the project manager for the Hawaii SoCal Testing and Training Environmental Impact Statement. It's a draft that's still under public review, and Alex described it for us.
This is an environmental impact statement that follows another one that we completed a few years ago in 2013. And the activities are important point I was trying to remind people is are the similar activities to what we've been doing in the waters around Hawaii for many decades.
Mm-hmm.
So this involves training our forces and testing new systems, but it's the same types of activities in the same areas.
In the course of that training, you're going to be setting off some explosive devices. You're going to be using sonar. Are those the kind of things whose impacts you're assessing?
Right. Yeah. So the environmental impact statement, it's a comprehensive science-based analysis of all of the impacts associated with testing and training. So we look at everything that could affect the environment during training and testing. The two primary stressors that were of most concern are the use of active sonar and training and testing that involves live ordnance or explosives. Those are the two main areas that
Sure.
really are the focus of the analysis.
What's active sonar?
Yeah, active sonar, we make that distinction because when the Navy trains or uses sonar in real-world activities, a lot of times we're not using we're not actually putting sound in the water. A lot of our sonar activities are passive. So in other words, we're just listening for things. We're just trying to detect things passively without putting energy in the water. But we also use active sonar, and that involves pinging, like the type of thing that you may be familiar with, pinging with the sonar to try and locate objects in the water. That's the active part.
Mm-hmm. It's not that different what from some marine animals do, right?
It's true, yeah. Many marine mammals rely on acoustic means of communicating and for their livelihood. Yeah, that's true.
What's the concern about the impacts of active sonar on them?
Yeah, well, the concern, and it's a lot of the impact analysis study in the EIS looks at how does the Navy's use of sonar affect marine mammals. And to kind of summarize the results of the environmental analysis is the vast majority of the types of impacts that would be expected from Navy sonar are changes to a marine mammal's behavior in a temporary way.
Uh-huh.
So in other words, the marine mammal may hear sonar and it could affect their behavior. The types of more serious types of impacts from sonar would occur only if the marine mammal was located very close to the sonar. And in that area, those areas where there could be a more serious type of impact, that's the area that we've developed mitigation measures to avoid those impacts.
Could they actually be physically hurt by a sound wave at close range?
If the marine mammal was very close to the sonar, yes, they could. And that's one of the reasons why we do the analysis and get the permit. But we establish safety zones around our activities like sonar for those areas close to where the sonar is, and we have lookouts that are trained to see marine mammals, and they're especially good at seeing marine mammals in that area close to where the ship is. And if we see marine mammals in that area, we would either power down the sonar or turn off the sonar completely.
When you talked about earlier, you made a reference to behavioral changes, not so much the really critical effects that we just discussed, but the behavioral changes. Is that a matter of a marine mammal that is used to communicating through this pinging, mistaking one of your sonar messages for some kind of signal from others of its kind?
The changes in behavior kind of span a spectrum of different types of changes in their behavior. You're right, like what you mentioned, a change in their behavior if they hear sonar is they could stop vocalizing. That would be a type of behavioral change. Or they could, change the direction that they're going or show an alert response. So there's a range of changes in behavior that, could be exhibited from them hearing the sonar. But again, these are all temporary changes in behavior that, would only last a, certain finite amount of time.
What about the impacts of the use of military ordnance?
Yeah, also kind of similar to sonar, but even really more concentrated in the specific areas around the, where the explosive is being used. So absolutely concerned about serious impacts to marine mammals if they're very close to an explosion. So for that reason, we establish a safety zone around an explosion. And we survey the area with our lookouts and any other means we have of detecting marine mammals where we're going to do an explosive-type training event. And we don't do the explosive event until we're sure that there are not marine mammals close to where where the explosive test is going to be. The thing about the energy from the explosives is the energy doesn't propagate for a long distance. Even though it's an explosive event that is, highly energetic, it doesn't have a large area. So the area that we clear is based on the size of the explosives. But the energy from explosions don't travel a great distance in the water.
So it's not likely to have an adverse impact much past the area that you've kind of sealed off is what it sounds like.
Right, that's true. That's true. And because that area is relatively small, we feel like we can do a pretty good job making sure that there's not marine mammals in that area.
This degree of awareness of environmental impacts has, how recent is it? How long has this been developing? How did it take to get us to where we are now?
Yeah, that's a good question. I would say, it's evolved over time. I mean, certainly, a generation ago, 20, 30 years ago, that the Navy didn't have this comprehensive suite of mitigation measures that we have now, where we really look at every single one of our activities and do whatever we possibly can to minimize environmental impacts while we're testing and training. But I'd say over the last, between 10 or 15 years, we've developed mitigation measures. And we've developed, the thing that's really important about our mitigation measures is that they have to be practical. They have to work in a real-world sense on a very complicated environment of a Navy shipboard activity while there are so many other things going on. So that's one of the things we're really proud of, is that we've developed these mitigation measures. They're the same mitigation measures we use across the Navy, and they're really effective and practical. I'd say in the last few years.
It's a welcome change, yeah?
Yeah, absolutely. I think, I would put the Navy's environmental stewardship right up there with any other organization, and I think it reflects the way the Navy is going, and also just the people that join the Navy, come with more of an environmental awareness and ethic than, in previous generations. So I think it's both because the Navy as an organization is going that way, and also the people that join the Navy, want to be proud of the environmental protection that they are able to do while they're out there doing their jobs.
Alex Stone is the senior environmental planner for the U.S. Pacific Fleet and is overseeing the Hawaii Southern California Training and Testing Environmental Impact Statement for the Navy. The draft EIS is available for public review through December 12th, and you can learn how to make your voice heard via our Hawaii Conversation Facebook page.
HPR's Atherton Studio is the place to find so many of Hawaii's musical stars. On Saturday the 18th, it's vocalist Star Kalahiki with her longtime collaborator, pianist Kit Ebersbach. They'll delight you with lounge standards, show tunes, and Hawaiian classics. Your tickets are at 955-8821 during business hours or hprtickets.org. Sponsored by Bonnie Rice and the Rice Partnership Wealth Management.
Are monster homes a blight on their communities, or simply a way for families to beat the high cost of living here? You'll hear both opinions, and you'll hear them loud and clear as the City Council debates proposals to regulate and Civil Beats. Chad Blair has that story in today's Reality Check. Hi, Chad.
Hi, Chris. Happy Aloha Friday.
We really got a chance to hear from the community at length in yesterday at the City Council in ways we haven't before, yeah?
It was really quite an earful, pro and con. Natanya Friedheim opens her story with a woman who's lived in Palolo Valley for a long time, and then suddenly a couple years ago, a developer shows up. They get a property next door to her, and then before you know it, there's a home with 17, I'll just repeat that, 17 yeah. bedrooms. And, of course, you mentioned these are called monster homes. This resident is complaining that not only did her neighborhood become a construction zone, but she's also having difficulty parking. It's no longer a peaceful and quiet neighborhood. On the other side, you do have folks saying, well, wait a minute, if you're going to curb the expansion of homes or making monster homes, is that going to actually hurt low-income folks, people that are immigrant families? Is this a cultural thing? Because of the high cost of living, as we all know, often you'll have multi-generational families in one home.
We often hear about communities in the city and county of Honolulu, Laiea and Kalihi come to mind,
sure.
where you hear of multiple families in single homes. I mean, that would support the argument that it is a little bit of a cultural thing.
Right. I mean, in some cases, there are homes with more than 25 bedrooms, and that raises a question. Is that for families, or are you actually renting those out for, short-term vacation purposes?
Mm-hmm.
There is no law in the city and county that limits how many family members can live in a home, but there is a law that says you can only have 5 unrelated people in that home, a limit on that. So that's a concern as well. The council did manage to approve a resolution asking the Department of Planning and Permitting to at least consider limiting the size of these houses, make it relative to the size of the property that they are built on. There was another measure which would have gone further and actually had a moratorium on these large-scale homes for 2 years until new rules are in place. That was deferred. We'll see whether the council decides to pick that up again.
You know, Chad, I'm wondering how you enforce a law to have no more than five unrelated people in a home. You
can just... Yeah, as if we don't have enough things to try and enforce around
exactly.
here. The DPP did say that they don't actually have a number on the size, the numbers of these large monster homes, but they have seen an increase in permits for homes that are larger than 3,600 square feet. So it does appear that there may be a trend here, and the council might have to take more serious action.
This story has really kind of exploded in recent weeks, so I'm betting we're going to be hearing a lot more about this, Chad.
Yes, and of course it all goes to the concerns of affordable housing here and the cost of living.
Yeah, all those stories tend to intersect after a while. Thanks a lot, Chad.
Thanks, Chris.
Every day we bring you a reality check from Civil Beat, today featuring reporter, political and opinion editor Chad Blair.
America's politicians just can't seem to agree on cutting carbon emissions to combat climate change. So what if we try something else, say injecting sulfur into the stratosphere to cool down the planet? I'm Ira Flatow. On the next Science Friday, we'll talk about the science and politics of geoengineering. It's all on Science Friday from PRI.
This afternoon from 1 to 3.
And on our Friday, we look at what's going on in Hawaii Public Radio's news department with Bill Dorman, our news director. Bill, we hear so many different proposed solutions to homelessness, no single one of which solves the whole problem. But this is a new one, isn't it?
Yeah, it's really true. And, you know, Thanksgiving week is probably an appropriate time to take a look at this. Kahuiki Village, this is the homeless families project on Oahu. Basic idea is to develop what they call an affordable plantation-style community for homeless families. Mm-hmm. And this is the one local businessman Dwayne Carisu is behind. But now he's got more than 40 for-profit and non-profit organizations working with this. It's also one of these public-private partnerships. So there's mm-hmm. some state money involved. There's some city and county money from Honolulu. But basically, getting this set up, it's on a little slip of land between Sand Island and Keihee Lagoon, Makai of Nimitz Highway. And they've been working on putting these things together. Some of the first families, actually, are going to be going in before Christmas. That's the schedule that they want to have. And this has just been an ongoing project, but, again, with specificity and with equipment and facilities on the ground. So Wayne Yoshioka is going to sort of take a look at where we are with that, where that project is, what they are looking at in terms of next steps.
That's kind of where the logjam comes in the homeless problem, in terms of making it worthwhile to provide shelters, right?
Well, and as you said, it's so complicated. There are so many strands
yeah.
to that issue, and it's everything from intake, from seeing what is out there, dealing on a daily basis with what is out there, and then moving people on to next stages. Transitional housing is some, but this is more permanent housing, which ultimately is where you want to wind up.
We'll look forward to that story. And there's an education story in the works.
Yeah, Kuvehi Hiraishi, working on a piece about project-based learning and a very specific example of that. Roosevelt High, there involves making kapa, the traditional Hawaiian bark cloth, but there is a lot to that. It's not just getting the right trees, although that's part of it, gathering the bark. You've got to get the trees at the right age, processing it, beating it into different
yeah.
stages, and it's experiential learning, so we'll get a bit on that.
A welcome alternative to the classroom, I would think.
No, it's true.
And something new as part of an old favorite.
Yeah, the Honolulu Printmaker Show and Sale. Always fun in Honolulu coming up just after Thanksgiving. Noe Tanigao is taking a look at this. This year, some new things, manga, zine folks, and people making handmade books.
Uh-huh.
Recently saw some of this at another city. Pretty fascinating. The stitching and what all is involved. Very, very creative, very colorful potential there. So that'll be fun.
That certainly will. Thanks a lot, Bill.
You bet.
Bill Dorman is HPR's news director.
I'm Jude Hill from Kailua. You're listening to The Conversation on member-supported Hawaii Public Radio.
There's a rally at the state capitol this evening to remind us that well before the federal government got serious about universal health care, Hawaii enjoyed the nation's highest rate of health insurance coverage. The Hawaii Prepaid Health Care Act was adopted in 1974, making our state the first in the U.S. to require minimum standards of health care benefits. Dean Neubauer is a professor emeritus at the UH Manoa Department of Political Science, who was a health care policy advisor to state government at the time. We spoke earlier this morning about the circumstances that led to health care reform here, and I asked him two questions. Could the Prepaid Health Care Act have happened today? And at the time of its enactment, could it have happened anywhere else?
As I've been just this second listening to you say that, it occurs to me that the way the Prepaid Health Care Act was produced was kind of a purposeful accident. Mm-hmm. And I would emphasize both sides of that. Purposeful in the sense that a lot of people worked very hard to make it happen, but accident in the sense that the kinds of circumstances that came together in Hawaii to produce it were not present anywhere else in the United States.
What was the year?
Well, the year is 67, if I have it correctly. It's mm-hmm. It's in that period. What struck me when I started working in some years ago was the extraordinary role that the Nixon administration played in that. Mm-hmm. If we put ourselves, you and I are old enough that we can do this.
That's right.
If we put ourselves back and say, I remember Medicaid when Medicaid was created. In 1965. And then the Nixon administration comes in, and one of the things that that administration sees it could do is to develop employer mandates in the states. And that comes out to Hawaii, as it does to the rest of the states. Hawaii hires a law professor from Berkeley, by the name of Reisenfeld, and he writes a report which becomes the basis of what will become Prepaid. And then it goes through a set of politics here, as you would imagine, and we pass it. No other state does.
Mm-hmm.
And then later on, a national piece of legislation called the ERISA Act is passed, and that prohibits states from doing this kind of thing. And at that point, it is challenged in the courts and goes to the United States Supreme Court. And the court finds against it. And then the Hawaii delegation works very hard, especially through the senior senator, to create an exception to it. And that becomes the ERISA exception, which allows Prepaid to stay in place.
Meaning that it could not have been enacted in any other state after that court decision?
That's correct. We in fact, got an exception. And people who did this for a living have told me that, on the one hand, that was great because we were able to save the majority aspects of Prepaid, which found their way into subsequent programs such as SHIP. But you could not then change the law, the Prepaid law, at the state level without further federal action, and that never happened.
So that froze it in place.
That froze it in place.
What was the climate in Hawaii at the time that made it possible?
Well, Hawaii, as we all know, is unique amongst the American states. One of the things that made it unique is that we had attained statehood late, but we also had a fundamental plantation economy, which dominated our societies on all islands. Mm-hmm. And everybody who studied healthcare in Hawaii from that period on, from the 50s on, believed that it was the fact of the what I'm going to call the paternalistic nature of the plantation economy, which made it possible to see an employer mandate is consistent with the culture of Hawaii. The other thing that made it possible, people think, is the fact that in that time, the mid-60s, that in the late 60s, the ILWU was still very powerful in Hawaii and had led to a whole set of legislation that had provided health care for all union workers. So when prepaid came on the scene, it was for non-union workers. Mm-hmm. And the idea was severalfold. One is that it would make health care accessible, but two, that it would help to control cost, and three, that it would allow us to have a smaller gap group. And the gap group is the percentage of people in the population who don't have health care.
And all those goals got accomplished.
They got accomplished. And then into the 90s, we began to have a more significant gap group. And I was associated with a group of people, including the HMSA Foundation and others, who were at that point trying to find out why that was happening. Mm-hmm. Because the gap group in Hawaii, various ways of counting it, may have gone as high as 10%. But after prepaid, and in those kind of robust years of early prepaid, we had the smallest gap group in the country.
And that was when Hawaii started being touted as kind of a model for the nation in terms of more people covered here than in any other
state.
Yes,
very much so. And then, the administration succeeded each other. And at one point, Jack Lewin became the director of the State Department of Health. And he was very eager to promote that model. And
this is the Waihei administration.
This is the Waihei administration, and this is now just another story that we needn't go into. But at one point, Jack thought that he could sell that to the incoming Clinton administration, and that came to be contested against what became the Hillary Clinton plan. But it was widely recognized in the United States as quite unique.
Does it hold to this day?
Well, it does and it doesn't because of the changes in the healthcare market. Three other things that were present in the early Hawaii experience. One was the importance of on Oahu of the Crown hospital facilities, especially Queens and Kapi'olani, which had mandates from their Crown investments. And by investments, I mean what was given to them to establish them. The second thing that was important was the effect of the state hospital system, which had established a hospital on all of the islands, and all of us have watched that throughout the years go through one form or another into privatization. But it was this basic duopoly between HMSA and Kaiser, which at the time that prepaid was established may have had 70% of the market. Extraordinary.
What you're describing, Dean, in a couple of ways, a society that was, in some sense, as a plantation society, monolithic. People were used to going to just a few sources for their income and for their health care, in the case of the two, Kaiser and HMSA. So everything was kind of manageable, given the size of the population, given the fact that a lot of things moved in the same direction.
Yeah, and close-knit ethnic communities, both on the plantation and moving off the plantation. Mm-hmm. I think we're all aware of what happened, for example, when Japanese Americans moved off the plantation and came to be way overrepresented in public education and public service, et cetera, et cetera. So part of what that was about, I think, my interpretation, is you also had what I would call cultural affinity based upon these kinds of things. And then when Philippine-American workers come in to replace largely Japanese-American workers after the strike in the 20s, that simply gets replicated. And so there is this close-knit looking after nature of healthcare. So
kind of gets to the very things in our local culture that we tend to celebrate.
Precisely.
Dean Neubauer is a professor emeritus at the University of Hawaii at Manoa Department of Political Science. He is also co-director of the Asia-Pacific Higher Education Research Partnership at the East-West Center and sits on Hawaii Public Radio's board of directors. There's a rally on the Capitol Rotunda today at 6 p.m. to celebrate the passage of the 1974 Hawaii Prepaid Health Care Act. In today's Backyard Quiz, we talked about a native honey creeper with a distinctive curved beak. It has adapted to the long tubular-shaped flowers of the lobelia, and it lives in the nectar of the lobelia, lives on the nectar of the lobelia, and the lobelia depends on these birds as well. The flower provides food for the bird pollinates the flower, carrying the pollen on its forehead. It's an example of coevolution, a symbiotic relationship to the benefit of two unrelated species. Scientists believe lobelia flowers evolved their long curved corolla at the same time that this particular honey creeper evolved its long and curved bill to fit into this particular long-throated flower where the life-giving nectar lives. Today we ask you to give us the Hawaiian name of this honey creeper. Lobelia are scarce these days, and the honey creeper, known by its Hawaiian name i'iwi, is under pressure to adapt accordingly. And Dave Hoppe-Cruz from Waianae knew the answer. Congratulations, Dave. You're today's winner. And that's today's quiz. If you've got one for us, you can send it to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. As people in Hawaii have known for a long time, you can get a lot of music out of a little ukulele, and as the instrument's popularity soars throughout the world, music therapists are learning it's an ideal tool for their hospital visits to young kids who are having a tough time. As we head into the weekend's Hawaii Ukulele Festival in Waikiki, we talked with Eddie Bonnier, the founder of Luthiers for a Cause, which has donated a series of handcrafted ukulele to that festival, about his reasons for founding his organization.
Music therapy is becoming an increasingly recognized part of the program to help kids heal. And what's beautiful about music therapy is not only does it help children deal with very difficult situations while they're undergoing treatment in the hospital, but what we're doing is sending kids home with ukuleles so they really get the gift of music for life. And many of them, you know, do continue to play music throughout not only their treatments, but beyond that for those who, you know, are able to, you know, get better.
It's a great starter instrument for the world of music, don't you think?
It is. It's really easy to play. You literally can learn three chords and you can play hundreds of songs.
Yeah.
But you can also take a lifetime to master the instrument. And in particular for the pediatric patients, it's very suitable because it's compact and it's easy to play lying down. You don't have to worry about interference with IV lines and things like that.
Yeah, yeah.
And there's a joyous voice to the ukulele that it's just brings a levity into the room for people.
You know, just thinking of the practical things of how to play it and how you're, the fact that you're lying down and mm-hmm. that's as much as important as anything else, really.
Yeah.
Just sheer access.
Yeah, and it's interesting because the Corey Bergman, the founder of the Ukulele Kids Club, he's actually a guitar player by background, and you know, in reacting to his own personal tragedy, he decided to do more in the way of community service. So he started going to a local hospital and visiting the pediatric ward and playing his guitar, and really noticed a lot of, you know, spirits being lifted up by what he was doing. And one day they called him over and they said, Corey, you know, we have a young man who is a musician. Can you come play for him? And, you know, the young man was really in not a good health situation. He was in a lot of pain. And when Corey came into the room, he really, you know, felt a lot better and started talking to Corey. And then, you know, he was pretty confident in his own guitar playing abilities. And, you know, Corey, you know, handed him the guitar. And it was difficult you know, because of the IV lines and stuff.
Sure.
And but Corey recognized then that the real bridge was to get instruments into the hands of the kids.
Yeah.
And he went and got an ukulele. He happened to have one that a friend had given him, and he brought it, and it was like, bang, this is perfect.
Everything pointed toward that particular instrument, And how did that, you know, the whole movement to get ukuleles into the hands of kids in the hospital, how did that expand?
So what happened was Corey and his wife, Etta, as they started telling people what they were doing and how they were dealing with their own situation, they were telling people we're buying ukuleles and contributing to them to hospitals. And then friends started handing them wads of $20 bills and say, you know, here, buy some instruments for us. And then it just kept getting, you know, bigger and bigger, and people really rallied around it. And then they formally launched a non-profit 501c3 a little over 4 years ago. Today there's over 200 hospitals in the program. We've gifted over 4,100 instruments. Our goal is to reach 10,000 instruments by the end of 2019. And it's really pretty incredible, some of the notes we get from parents after the fact saying, you know, your music therapy and the joy that this brought into my child's life has been such a blessing. It's really, really heartwarming to hear. Of course, you know, sometimes we do get the tough letters when we find out that a recipient has passed on, but even then, the parents are appreciative for the joy that music brought to their child while their child was still enduring treatment.
Eddie, have you done some of these music therapy visits?
You know, I have not, and I'm glad you asked that question. You know, the music therapy programs, which the Ukulele Kids Club supports, these are with board-certified music therapists. So these are people who've gone through serious training, and it's part of a program with, you know, doctors who are overseeing, and it is a prescriptive type thing. And often hospitals that do have music therapy programs, you know, parents can ask about it, or often it can be recommended to them for their child.
Can just a regular musician be trained as a music therapist, or does it require some medical training as well?
I don't know that it requires medical training per se, you know, but there is a training program, and there is a board process for getting certified.
And that, and after that, you can do the
you've
witnessed these sessions.
And it's, you know, these are music educators who've taken an affinity for, you know, helping children in these and adults in these tough situations. We're also seeing growing use of music therapy with adults, particularly in seniors, for example. There's lots of benefits there. Today,
I've heard that, and that you hear stories of music being able to reach people who can't be reached any other way. You know, the severely autistic Alzheimer's patients.
Absolutely.
Right.
Yeah.
Is that it seems also as if that's kind of a new area of study, that we're just learning more about that, the value of music therapy all the time.
Yeah, it's really incredible, and I think it's remarkable. It shows in some cases really, you know, the brain is such a powerful thing that we don't really understand, and there's things deep inside of our brains that only get unlocked in certain situations. And, you know, the interesting question is, how do you tap into that without having to go through some of these situations? But it's really, really fascinating.
Well, as they say, there's a link between music and the music of the spheres, right?
Yeah.
You've seen some of these music therapy sessions in action, right?
Yeah.
What do you see?
You know, like I said, you have kids who are, you know, often, you know, they might be getting an IV and need a distraction. It might be part of a regular program for them. And, you know, kids, you know, really react to the instrument. It's distracting for them. It gives them a sense of control because now they've got something they can do when they want. Sometimes with the younger kids, they will talk about some of the experiences that they're going through, and the music therapist, for example, could help them write a song, and the music therapist will play the song, and then if it's a particularly young child, they'll just strum along.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a good way to get them to share about what they're going through. You know, and as kids get older, then they're, you know, learning chords and playing songs themselves, and you know, writing their own music in many cases.
When you get to the point where you feel that you've created something, you've really gotten somewhere, haven't you?
Yeah.
I mean, that's it sounds as if, in a way, Eddie, this parallels your own journey as an ukulele player, right? You found something in the instrument for yourself personally.
Yeah, personally, my discovery of the instrument, my daughter was interested in taking up the violin when she was about five, and we visited a local music store, and she was talking to the violin teacher, and violin teacher was helping her pick a violin. I turned around to these small instruments hung on the wall, and I just strummed one, and I thought, that is a very unusual sound I'm not familiar with, but it really stuck with me, and I kept looking at them, and I asked one of the people at the store, what is this? And they said, it's an ukulele. I went home and Googled ukulele and researched it all weekend, and then I found out that, you know, it's really easy to learn, but it's, you know, you can spend a lifetime mastering it. And at the time, I felt like, you know, I was approaching 50, and I wanted to do something completely different to challenge myself. And if you had told me before I walked in that music store I would become obsessed with ukulele, I would have told you you were out of your mind, but that's in fact what happened.
Eddie Monnier is the founder of Luthiers for a Cause, which has created a series of handcrafted ukulele that will be unveiled tomorrow afternoon as part of the weekend-long Hawaii Ukulele Festival, sponsored by the Ukulele Guild of Hawaii, at the Princess Kaiulani Hotel in Waikiki. You can get details on our Hawaii Conversation Facebook page.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributors Ulupono Initiative and Impact Hub Honolulu Co-working.
And that's it for this week on The Conversation. Coming up next week, ACLU's legal director Mateo Caballero joins us to talk about the limits of free speech after the case of a Virginia woman who was fired from her job after photographs of her protesting appeared on social media. We'd like to hear from you. You can call our talkback line and leave us your comments at 808-792-8217. You can email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. If you missed part of this show, you can find them all on our HPR app. The program is produced by Lillian Song, Ryan Finnerty, and Amber Kahn. Our intern is Emily Cardinale. And the Backyard Quiz theme was written for us by John DeMello. I'm Chris Vandercook. Join us Monday and pick up the conversation.